From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in New Jersey, when a young couple headed across the river and entered a small room, very small, cozy, maybe a little smoky. The couple was there on a night out to see a woman sing, and her name was Mabel Mercer. It was a no-fuss performance. Mercer wasn't there to tell long stories, talk about herself. She was wearing a simple gown, holding a kerchief that matched. She sat with her back to the piano. She would say, "Good evening," and then introduce the next song, and the next song. And that was it, just the purity of music, the clarity of a gorgeous voice singing great songs. And the young couple thought that night, what more could we want for our money? It was perfect. Times have changed, but the man on that date night has become one of the most prolific chroniclers of the great American songbook. His name is Michael Lasser, and he has channeled his passion and his keen sense of observation into several books and a radio career that has touched so many of us. He has done this for four decades on his nationally syndicated weekly radio show, Fascinating Rhythm, for which he won a Peabody Award in 1994. Michael Lasser says it's time. He's preparing for his final broadcast on June 26th. And I thought, you know, every time we talk, I learn something. I learn a lot of things, of course. I learn about music. I usually learn something about life. I always learn about broadcasting from a man who has the voice that I would kill for. Michael Lasser is here, the host of Fascinating Rhythm, an author, a teacher, a theater critic. It is lovely to see you here.
And to see you again. At this stage in the game, it's lovely to see anybody.
It is wonderful to see people.
Who would have thought that going to Wegmans could be exhilarating?
Marianne Carberry is here, the original producer of Fascinating Rhythm and a program host for Classical 91.5.
Evan, it's great to be here. What a great day, really, to celebrate just a wonderful career on the radio for Mike Lasser and for all of us and for WXXI.
It's been an absolute pleasure for all of us. And you know, I loved that story you told Marianne about Mabel Mercer because of how much it felt truly of its time, how different it must be compared to modern music performance. What strikes you when you think about nights like that?
The intimacy of it.
Mm-hmm.
You could live, these were in tiny rooms called boites, B-O-I-T-E-S, from the French. Box. They were tiny. The table was the size of a postage stamp. The incredible clarity and precision of the singing, not only in terms of pronouncing the words so you could hear them, but the use of precision and more deeply craft, the craft in the writing and the craft in the singing, to take you into the song more deeply, to make it, to take hold of whatever authenticity it possessed and give it to the audience. I'm a believer that craft is not the opposite of authenticity. I believe deeply that it makes authenticity possible, because ultimately there's the song and there's us, the listener. And in between is the singer, and the singer is the transmitter. You know, the singer is the liaison between us. And if the craft isn't there in the singing or the writing, God, the writing, because my main interest has always been more songwriters.
Well, you're an old English teacher.
Yeah, in the songs and in the songwriters than in the singing. Obviously, I have my favorite singers. But if the craft isn't there, then all you've got, to borrow a title of a very funny song by George and Ira Gershwin, all you've got is blah, blah, blah.
Can I ask both of you about something that really kind of, when I think of this image of you in the room with Mabel Mercer, and I think of what it looks like when people go see music now live, which we're doing again, and we're going to start to do more of soon. Modern technology, I think, has made it less intimate. Everyone wants to. I don't really understand this either. I see this in baseball games. People are taking video on their phones of every play, even though it's broadcast by ESPN. I promise your cell phone is not as good as ESPN's quality. People are taking everything on cell phones, and I don't want to be a get off the lawn guy, as Jeff Spivak and you talked about in his wonderful piece for City.
It was really good.
It was a great piece. Read that, Jeff. Everything that Jeff does is great. He should be hosting this show. But I think about the way people consume music, and I think it's just less intimate. And I'm almost glad when I think about your own experiences that you didn't have the burden of of having to ask yourself, do I want to get this on cell phone? You were just there, right?
Not only that, no microphone. We heard the human voice. Wow. We've had, and that's really where the point that you're making started. Rooms got big, and so everybody was mic'd, and everything got electronic. The instruments, the singing, the electronic piano, the electronic violin, the electronic harmonica. I mean, you can easily do a humorous piece in the New Yorker on that. But it's the method of presentation became impersonal. And so pretty soon we learned that. And we have generations now that have grown up. And again, this isn't a knock, it's an observation. I have my preferences, obviously. We've had generations now grow up without really hearing the sound of the human voice singing. That's a loss.
Unadorned by technology.
Yeah, that's a loss.
Yeah. What do you think about that contrast?
I agree. And I also think that I think that if people are given the opportunity to experience what Mike and Elaine experienced, they would gladly do that. But number one, it's finding those performers who have that amazing ability to communicate the music like Mabel Mercer did, or like Bobby Short, who used to be at the Cafe Carlyle in New York City.
Blossom Dearie.
Blossom Dearie, right. And I dreamed, I never got to see Bobby Short, but one of my dreams was to go to the Cafe Carlyle and hear him perform. But it was packed every night. I mean, you had to inherit tickets to go to that. So my point is, I think that people still crave that. And it's finding that perfect combination of things. And it kind of only seems to happen mostly in New York City. Unfortunately, not around places like this.
It happens. Certainly happens in big cities. Mm-hmm. That intimacy, that give and take between, again, song, performer, and audience. And it still works. And it still works with these songs. And I'll tell you, well, first of all, in cabarets, jazz singers, jazz musicians still use these songs. The songs of the Great American Songbook are the essential body from which jazz performers draw the material. Take your grandson or granddaughter to a revival of an old Broadway musical like Oklahoma or Annie Get Your Gun or South Pacific. The Great American Songbook is not the music of today. It's had its time. I think it still has lasting value and appeal, but that's a subject for a book which I happen to be writing right now. But you take these kids who are used to listening to whatever is in, whatever the thing is, whether it's hip-hop or hard rock or whatever it is, whatever is in is what they're into, as they should be. I mean, we grew up on the music of our own time. But you plop them in a seat, and the curtain goes up, and they're listening to songs by Irving Berlin and Rodgers and Hart and the Gershwins, and they're loving it. It connects. The emotionalism is so skillfully presented, assuming it's a good production, because if it wasn't, it would have closed by now. And it still works. You just have to give people a chance. Again, you don't give up what's now. You're not supposed to. But you don't have to say, I live only in this bubble.
No, I think there's something really beautiful about that because, you know, you're not at 85 saying, well, this is what I wrote about. This was my passion. And it happens to be the best. And everything today is crap, even though it might be. But you're saying, look, like what's hot today. Get into it. But also don't be afraid to connect to what made this so universal, because that may be truly timeless. It may always be that way when people hear that music. Do you think, Marianne?
I do. And my daughter majored in musical theater, and excuse me, she graduated about 10 years ago. But it was interesting that they called her pre-1960 Meg, because she came into the program knowing all the Gershwin and the Porter and it wasn't just because I loved it, or her father loved it, and or she listened to Mike Lasser as a 2-year-old. But she just had a sensibility about that. But it was interesting that even the musical theater students did not know it. But once they started to learn it, because they were required to, they absolutely felt that it resonated with them. They didn't have to just do something from Rent or Spring Awakening, or all of which are fantastic. They really felt that touched them once they started to know what the motivation was. Because as a performer, you have to know deep down what that song is trying to say.
And you have to honor the song.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you don't interpret it. You find your own phrasing as a singer. But you do it in the spirit of the song. You don't impose you on it. You let it guide you.
We're going to have some music coming up, I promise. We can't have Michael Lasser here and not have music. But let me ask one more question before we get to some music, if I could. You told Marianne in an interview a couple years ago that songs reflect what's in the drinking water, that songs reflect what people are thinking and feeling and doing of the time. And that got me thinking about culture. And I have like a kind of a little hypothesis that I want you to correct if it's wrong. Sometimes art is a reflection of culture, art of any kind. Sometimes art drives the culture and can change the culture. And I am under the sort of the impression that the songs in the Great American Songbook reflected the culture rather than drove it, because there was a still understated, careful commercial aspect of, most were men, were not pouring their souls out. Cole Porter couldn't, Cole Porter was gay, couldn't really write about his personal life. So there was still a careful craftsmanship, a great craftsmanship, but maybe more of a reflection of culture than driving culture?
Yeah, the Great American Songbook is, in fact, mainstream commercial popular music, mainly between the wars. It extends forward, it extends back. I used to cheat a certain amount on the program. I go back to the turn of the century. I go back to Stephen Foster. I'd come up to Stephen Sondheim. But mainly it was 1920 to 1950. The songwriters were craftsmen, along with the few women. It was only a few women, but there were some great ones, Dorothy Fields especially. But they also were interested in money. Most of them came from poor backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And they were out to make money, and they made a lot of it, if they were any good. And it was that mix that was at work. It did reflect the culture. Now, protest songs have always been here. And popular music has absorbed a certain amount of that, beginning with the folk music business of the 1960s. Toward the end of Seeger's life, Pete Seeger was on stage with Bruce Springsteen. And a number of Springsteen songs can be identified as protest.
Sure.
Including Born in the USA, his iconic song.
One of the most misunderstood songs in pop.
Yep, his iconic song.
Yeah.
By an iconic figure. But they were cautious. There was a conservatism. It was also a culture in which we pretty much agreed on certain things. We didn't have to carve out our own morality in those years. It was passed on. It was largely agreed upon. But the sentiments in the song of those years really are not only of their time, in that love is love. And whether you're having sex or not at the age of 16, if you're in love, you get it. They're not only about adolescent love, which songs since the 50s have been more often than before. They're about love. And whether you're an adolescent or an old codger, you get it. And so they're about the thrill of falling in love, the confusion. If I'm not in love, do I want to fall in love again? I've been hurt. Is it worth it? Yes, it is. I keep hitting the mic because it's not where I'm used to mics being.
This is not your studio. You're in my studio, man. This is the people's studio.
And I'm remembering love. I'm hoping for it again. I'm dreading it again.
Sure, timeless.
And so those emotions, that is, if you take love, anything you can say about love, it's a very long line. Each song is a tick. Mm-hmm. One moment, because mm-hmm. they're miniatures.
Not just about love, by the way. I've said this before. Michael Lasser's the guy who has taught me that there's a lot more sex in these songs than I realized.
But they had to be indirect about it.
Sure.
I mean, listen to a song like Night and Day. There's not a single mention that's awry, naughty. But that throbbing music, the heat of it all, I mean, how could it not be about sex unless you're afraid of it or unless you haven't figured out what sex is yet? One of the things that adolescents need to learn is that sex really takes place between your ears and the rest of it is plumbing.
This is why I love talking to Michael Lasser. Do you see? Is this what your life was like producing for him?
Oh, yeah. We had to edit out so much stuff.
Oh, Dave.
It was R-rated.
Dave Sliberski, who, by the way, I did not win the Peabody. Dave Sliberski and I won the Peabody. He was the engineer in those years. And Andrews is wonderful, and Dave was wonderful. But Dave gave it its feel and with the technical side of it. And Andrew has continued that with his own doing what he does. But the idea that sex stopped existing, give me a break. It's in there. You just have to listen. Do it again. I should say no.
Family radio, Michael Lasser. Right?
It's a song about a kiss, as you find out eventually. But listen to it.
See, now everybody wants to go back and listen. I have a letter from Dave Sliberski that I'm going to read, by the way. Dave says, I remember joining WXXI in 1984 as an audio engineer for radio and having to learn as fast as possible because there were so many opportunities, and one of the best was as audio engineer for your show, Michael. In the beginning, there were producers assigned for the show, but that changed over time, and finally we just decided, let's do this ourselves. Some of the most challenging aspects we discovered were gaining our composure from laughing so hard from jokes or outtakes. We laughed so much that it never felt like work. I enjoyed our camaraderie and appreciated you for valuing my input on the show's themes, as well as agreeing to letting me put my stamp on pacing, adapting to changes in technology, and being open to how we did the show. When iTunes first came out, the world was skeptical, if you remember. You had no source for the 1889 Irish song McNamara's Band, and we found it in iTunes in just 3 minutes. The fact that they even had that song in the early stages of iTunes was impressive. It became another great source for the show. Being at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York City in 1995 to accept our George Foster Peabody Award was so memorable. We were in the same room with astronaut Alan Shepard, with Dan Rather, General Norman Schwarzkopf, Barbara Streisand, the entire cast of Seinfeld and ER, and sitting right behind me was Kitty Carlisle. It was just unbelievable. This show taught me so much about history, music, musical artists, and the business of music, to name just a few topics. Working with you made this happen, and I also offer my thanks to all those along the way who supported the show, both in and out of WXXI. I have a pretty good shot at naming any recorded artist from Wax Cylinders till now from the Great American Songbook. I enjoyed my 25 years as part of the show. It was hard to say goodbye when I left in 2009 to teach full-time at RIT. Life goes on, as we both know so well, and I owe you heartfelt, unending gratitude, or, as Bob Hope once sang, thanks for the memories. That's from Dave.
Oh, my.
Very nice, Dave.
Oh, God. May I have a copy of that when we're done?
Of course you can.
All right. I think
it's
we
all
should.
Yours,
I got a song for you.
What do you have?
It's in its way for Dave. It's a song by the Gershwins, sung by Michael Feinstein.
Nice work if you can get it.
Nice work if you can get it.
Let's listen to some of that, and then we'll have Michael Lasser tell us more about this.
Thank you.
lives for making money, lives a life that isn't necessarily sunny. Likewise, the man who works for fame, there's no guarantee that time won't erase his name. The fact is, the only work that really brings enjoyment is the kind that is for girl and boy men. Fall in love, you won't regret it. That's the best work of all if you can get it. Holding hands at midnight, neath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
So, as we listen a little bit more of this, go ahead. The floor is yours. Tell us about this one.
First of all, work is a metaphor for love, which is kind of funny in and of
itself. I thought you were going
to
say sex again.
No, love, love. For boy and girl meant.
Yeah.
But if you had the lyric in front of you on a piece of paper, you would see the mastery of the sound devices that these men and women had. Rhyme, obviously, and not phony rhyme like time.
Michael thinks nobody today can rhyme anymore.
Well, they can. They
if
don't.
You know Michael Esser, you know they just
but they don't
do
have
it.
They don't have the discipline.
Yeah.
They rhyme time and mind. They don't rhyme. They're nice words, but they don't rhyme. They were exact. If there's time in a minute, I'll tell you a story about that. How I got nailed. they use rhyme. They use alliteration. They use consonants. They use repetition, which is tricky because you got so many few words to use.
Mm-hmm.
They use internal rhyme. They rhyme within the line. It's constant. They make up rhymes. Beans could get no keenery, ception in a beanery. Lorenz Hart, bless our mountain greenery, triple rhymes. They use quadruple rhymes. They are masters of the techniques of sound. They and poets take from the same bag, but they're not poets. They're lyricists.
Sure.
That's a whole chapter.
No,
in the new
book. I hear a little Ogden Nash in what you're doing here, which I always loved. But.
Let me tell you this story.
I once
had a chance to interview Sammy Kahn, the song lyricist, major lyricist. And he said to me at one point, how do you pronounce Y-O-U-R? And I said, your. How about Y-O-R-E? And I said, your. And he said, how about Y-O-U apostrophe R-E? And I said, your. And he took his two fists and he slammed the table and he said, no, damn it, it's your. They were that meticulous in their work.
Can't get away with just saying your.
You can't be sloppy. Yeah. No, they prided themselves on their craft.
Whew.
Yeah, yeah.
You said the greatest lyricist. You've said this. I don't know if you still agree with yourself on this. Johnny Mercer.
Probably, but there are so many. Mercer, Harburg, Gershwin, and the two who were among the few true songwriters, Berlin and Porter, wrote their own lyrics. But most of these people were not songwriters. They were either composers or lyricists. They collaborated.
People might hear E.Y. Harburg.
Oh, yeah.
And not
yep, yeah, no, I know.
That's the one that people might say, I don't know it. Why don't people know E.Y. Harburg?
I don't know.
Should they know?
Certain names get lost. Yeah. So does Harry Warren's name. Warren called himself the most famous songwriter nobody's ever heard of. he wrote 42nd Street. He wrote Lullaby of Broadway. He wrote You'll Never Know, the music. Harburg wrote the lyrics to Paper Moon, April in Paris, all the songs in Wizard of Oz, including Over the Rainbow. But his name just hasn't stuck. And it's a shame because they belong up there at the very pinnacle of American popular song.
Marianne, for you over the years, do you feel that you've absorbed so much of what his audience has absorbed, or even I absorb in short conversations with Michael? What has it meant to you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, especially when I was working directly with Mike, I think that's when I learned the most about it. And we also did a documentary sort of on Irving Berlin, which I had always appreciated him, but then I came to appreciate him on a whole other level. And so in that way, I absorbed it. But for a long time, I've just been a listener like everyone else. And I have to say that I think that we have to also give a thank you to the listeners of WXXI, because I think that, as to say this during membership drives, there's an openness, there's a curiosity, there's also a sophistication about this community of music lovers that maybe this show wouldn't necessarily have thrived like it has here. So we have to give a shout out to the milieu in which this show has thrived. Would you agree with that, Mike?
I would. And I remember that Irving Berlin show. We didn't have enough records to do it with. All LPs in those years.
Yeah.
The combination of popular music and Broadway musicals. One half shelf in the record library. And over the years, we built it up to thousands of CDs. And I still was using the LPs right up to the end, because certain songs had never, or certain recordings had never made their way onto LP. So we got a check, I think, for $50. And we went to Record Archive. Is that the place?
I think it was $75.
Oh, my goodness.
Do you know what you can get for $75 at Record Archive?
I know. And especially like in the early 80s, it was a lot of money.
And so we went over there, and God, we took out a pile of records that was almost half of what we must have taken out 20 or 30 records that had to be in decent shape, obviously, because they would be played on the air. But we both walked out with our eyes this big, and then we were able to do that Irving. We did a three-part Irving Berlin show.
Yeah, I think it was for his 90th birthday.
And he lived to be 101.
Yeah, he did. So it was great fun. So for me, yes, and I'm down here at just looking up, gazing up at Mike, because my knowledge is just a little tiny, but I've tried to sort of absorb as much as I can, as we all have.
Yeah, but when you work on something for 40 years, you're bound to learn something. And that's not modesty, that's just an observation.
Michael's been teaching us for so long, and Mary writes to say, heartfelt thanks for a wonderful program that was consistently well done over the years. Always found the time to tune in and listen. Bravo, and thank you.
Thank you.
That's from Mary, and I think that speaks for so many of Michael's listeners and fans and those who appreciate Fascinating Rhythm, of which Michael, when we come back from this only break, Michael will tell us a little bit about June 26th coming up, his last broadcast of that, how you made the decision. We're going to see if he remembers what he said about, I know we're doing songwriting. Michael loves singers, but he loves songwriting. So we're going to stick mostly with songwriting. Who's the greatest songwriter ever? Michael Lasser says Irving Berlin. We've got some Irving Berlin coming up. But who did Michael Lasser say the following about one particular singer? There ain't none better ever. We'll see if he has the same opinion now. He says he knows it. Michael Lasser, Marianne Carberry, and coming right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, we talk to two more candidates for the Rochester City School Board. More interviews, more chances for you to talk to the candidates before you vote on June 22nd. WXXI has coverage of City Council, the mayoral race, and the school board, not only on election night, but before then, to get you prepared as voters. More coming your way Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. If you have thoughts for Michael Lasser, because I know we've had some feedback from some listeners, but if you want to try to send it directly, you can email classical@wxxi.org. classical@wxxi.org. I know Michael appreciates every message, and there's been such a great connection with the people in this community and, frankly, listeners everywhere for 40 years. When did you know now's the time? This is good. This is good. This is right.
Half or two-thirds of the way through the year of COVID.
Of COVID, yeah.
Yeah, it's been all repeats for the last 14 or months or so. And so I started to feel very distant from it. Mm-hmm. And I've been working on books, and I love the bigness of them. Frustrating as all get out, but I love the bigness of them. And I began to wonder and think. And two thoughts hit me, and they were really the decisive ones. One, do I, at my age, where I have to write fast, do I really...
Don't make me laugh at this, Michael.
Do I really want to come up against deadlines anymore?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've been doing that all my life, as have we all. I don't want to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to say... That was a self-censorship moment there.
Thank you for that.
And the other thing was, I wanted to go out at the top of my game on my own terms, mm-hmm. to list two cliches. I didn't want to hang around until people started saying things like, have you thought about maybe cutting back? I didn't want to do that. I wanted to leave when I knew the show was still working, and when I felt I had done good work, and do it on my terms.
What do you have planned for June 26th?
It's a repeat.
But can you talk to us at all about
your
emotion knowing that that's, I mean, like, what will that day like be like for you?
When I made the decision, I was very contented.
Yeah.
Someone said to me, are you happy about it? I said, no, happy. I mean, I'm not doing cartwheels. It's not about happiness. Why would I be happy giving up something that's meant a great deal to me for 40 years? But I'm contented. In the best sense, I've made the right decision for the right reasons, and now I still have some life to live. So I don't know. I'm not good at predicting feelings. I'm not good at predicting the future. But I'll certainly listen that day and see what it does to me.
Well, can I observe a couple of things?
Please do.
So on the subject of your books, you've offered a real gift in those.
Thank you.
Those will be taught. They will be studied. They will be reference points for as long as humans are around. They really will. It's such a fascinating time in American musical history and culture, and your books are a chronicle of that.
Thank you. That's not only an impressive compliment, but coming from somebody who knows a lot of stuff, it means more. The one that I think comes closest to what you're talking about is the most recent imprint, City Songs and American Life. And the next one, I don't know what the title will be yet. The publisher has the final say on the title. I mean, it's a negotiation. Nobody stands there with a club.
Sure.
I call it I Hear America's Song, but we'll see how that ends up when it comes into
Marian,
print.
Marian, these books are going to be important for a long time, aren't they?
I think so. And Mike has not mentioned that he has donated his resources, his research, and you can correct me, maybe copies of the shows to Nazareth College.
Yeah,
right?
My CD copies, plus all the scripts and schedules, have gone to the Nazareth College Library. And I chose Nazareth because people automatically say, why didn't you pick the U of R? Mm-hmm. I chose Nazareth because it's the only college in the area that has both a theater and a music department.
Wonderful. You say that it was about maybe two-thirds of the way through our COVID year that it started to feel like time. I'm particularly sorry for you that COVID hit not long after you lost your wife.
Oh, thank you. Don't make me cry.
Well, I don't want to do that, but I just want to ask how you are.
I'm okay. Well, right now, not so hot. But I've made a life. I miss her like crazy. But I'm okay. You know, people say, how are you? And I say, doing the best I can. And some days that's great, and some days not so hot.
Let's get back to some
music.
Yeah,
okay. Thank you for asking.
You said the greatest. Well, first of all, let's put this on the record.
Yeah,
Michael knew.
On.
He wants to. Put it on the record. Michael says on the subject of singing, there ain't none better ever. Who was it?
Rosemary Clooney.
Rosemary Clooney. Why the best to you?
Oh, God. The phrasing, the musical intelligence. I had the chance to interview her three different times, and I've seen her perform any number of times. She is a quintessential professional. I once asked her how she chose a song, and she said the lyrics. And that struck me, because here's a singer talking about
the lyrics,
words.
Yeah.
And she's not the only singer who's told me that. I started asking that question when I did interviews. And I asked her about it, and she said, I have to believe in it if I'm going to make you believe in it for the 3 minutes that I'm singing it. In other words, it was a kind of, and this is an oxymoron, genuine acting. And that's where the craft comes in. It's genuine phoniness.
Isn't that so interesting?
It's genuine.
It seems like an oxymoron, but it works.
Genuine inauthenticity. You know, these songs were not personal. Today, songwriters are supposed to be personal, even confessional. They're authentic. These people were not. They were exercising craft. And one of the things I argue in the new book is that craft deepens authenticity rather than undoing it. We live in a world that's shaped in many ways by adolescent values. And that's an adolescent value, that authenticity is all. You just need to feel it. No, you need to be able to do it, or else everybody would be a great artist. Everybody would be a great poet. Everybody would be a great dancer. Everybody would be a great songwriter. Uh-uh. You need, God gives you the talent, and then what do you do with it? You acquire the skill, the craft, and the discipline. Not sincerity without craft is earnestness, the dreariest of all the virtues.
So, Marian, I'd love to get your take on this because, the notion of writing something or singing and performing something that doesn't necessarily reflect exactly your life has been going on forever.
Right.
Slate.com had an article about what they deemed to be the worst pop star of all time, which they say is Billy Joel. And I thought, why? And they say because, for example, he writes songs like Allentown about working in steel mills. Uh-huh. And they said it's the most inauthentic attempt at appropriating the life of the working man. You know, they said nobody's buying this. The guy's got a helicopter pad. Nobody thinks it's real. And I just thought that was interesting because what they're actually reflecting is what Michael Lasser says is they don't have the authenticity. They were saying that Billy Joel is, and I'm sure some listeners may disagree, but they were saying that it doesn't reflect an attempt at really feeling and authentically delivering the song, even if you didn't live it. And what he's saying is Rosemary Clooney and so many others did that. Do you see that distinction too?
I do. And I'm not so sure that I agree about Billy Joel.
That's a whole other show.
That's a whole other show about, about how people, Barbara Streisand, people feel that she connects with people and what kind of a lifestyle does she have? So it's all about the artist, as Mike would say, and connecting on such a personal level, right? And so I kind of, that's a whole show, isn't it?
Yeah, they were. They didn't write about themselves. You know who they were writing about? Us.
Right.
It was on our minds, if it was in our hearts, it ended up in a popular song. They weren't giving personal testimony. Songwriters today, and this sounds like a shot, and it may be just a little, in effect are letting you listen in. But it's not about you, it's about them.
That's an interesting distinction. And it also strikes me that in the Great American Songbook era, they wouldn't have succeeded in their work, in their craft, to use the term that you love, if they weren't good at understanding what they were writing about, even if it wasn't their own life.
And bringing the craft to it.
Sure.
Yeah. There it is. So that a song like when Irving Berlin was quite young, he married. He was a songwriter. He was established. He'd already written Alexander's Ragtime Band. And he married, and he and his wife went on a honeymoon. She contracted typhoid fever, and 6 months later, she was dead. He was devastated. Couldn't write. Couldn't get past this torpor. And eventually, he put it all into a song, which was the most natural thing in the world for him to do. And it's very short. I lost this, I lost that, I lost this, I lost that when I lost you. Are those his emotions, or are his emotions channeled into the material of a popular song? See? And I don't know. Nobody knows. I do know that by putting it into a song, it freed him to write again. And the next song he wrote was upbeat and funny and jubilant. It's called When the Midnight Choo-Choo Lives for Alabama. But if he was sad, how could he write that? Because it wasn't a reflection of his own emotions. It was the job, in the highest sense of the word, the task, the commitment. And you wrote those songs not with sincerity, but with integrity. You served the needs of the song.
An Education with Michael Lasser, whose final broadcast, A Fascinating Rhythm, June 26, 44 decades, really, of remarkable award-winning work. And we're so glad at WXXI to have been the home for that. Home is wherever you hang your hat, though, as you know.
Johnny Mercer, any place I hang my hat is home.
I studied. Let me grab a phone call, and then we've got more music. This is Nancy. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just wanted to congratulate Michael on his 40 wonderful years. You have given me such good Saturday mornings.
Thank you, Nancy.
And I'm 82.
Well, you're chasing me.
And I have to tell you, my dad and I used to dance around the kitchen to all that wonderful music.
Yeah.
In the
summer, my parents would roll up the rug. Remember when people did that in the summer? And they would have friends over, and it was a wooden floor, and they would dance. They would turn on the radio, and they would dance. And I watched.
I hope dancing isn't a lost art either, but I know that the words were what caught my attention, the wonderful words of the war songs that were written and all those funny songs that we all wanted to sing, and just wonderful artists. But I loved the funny words, the meaningful words. They just don't write music like that anymore. I'm sorry they don't, but they don't.
I'll leave you
and
with
rap
two.
Rap isn't even coming close.
I'll leave you with two words. Mares eat oats.
And oats eat oats and little lambs eat ivy.
Nancy, thank you.
Enjoy your retirement.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nancy. Bye-bye. What a wonderful call. Andrew says, I started listening to Michael Lasser way back when. He is one of the reasons WXXI in Rochester is great and respected nationwide. He's also the reason I collect popular 78s for my Victrola. Mm-hmm. Michael, while you deserve a nice retirement, we will miss you.
Thank you.
That's from Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew.
Kathy, thank you, Michael Lasser, for so many hours and years of music and memories. You will be missed. The list goes on here. Tributes to Michael Lasser. Greg says, just learning that Michael's show is coming to a conclusion. How sad for so many and for those who need introduction and nurturing on the Great American Songbook. Where will show archives reside and will they be accessible, please? That is from Greg.
YouTube is a treasure chest.
Okay. So, Greg, good luck to you. Let us know if you're having any trouble finding them. And Yvonne says, just tuned in. I love Michael Lasser's voice. What a joy he is to hear. He does. Marianne, this guy's got the best radio voice.
I didn't know that. I was a simple school teacher in upstate New York.
He just took his teacher's demeanor and just transferred it. I think he was so comfortable as a teacher, and that's a good thing. You know, it worked out well.
But I mean, when, Michael, did you actually know? When did you say, wow, I really, because you and I are at least similar in that when people meet us, if they listen to us, they say, oh, you sound like you do on the radio, which is a nice compliment.
Yes, it is a nice compliment.
But your voice is, you know, I mean, if you could put it in a bottle, you could pour it on pancakes.
But I didn't know that. I'm a kid who grew up just outside New York City. I used to say fine and far. And I don't know. I will tell you when I felt natural. I used to speak from notes back in the old days when it was Anything Goes. And then it went into syndication. We had to change the name because in those years there was a show called Anything Goes already. And Bill Pierce, who was then general manager, came up with Fascinating Rhythm. And I had to write a script. And it felt very awkward to me because I was reading. It felt mannered. It felt artificial. And Dave Slaberski was on the other side of the window doing the tech, except he was turned 90 degrees because of where the board was. And I started talking as I was reading. I was talking to Dave. I was talking to his ear, actually. And that taught me how to make it sound like talking when you're reading. And because I could focus on a person. And I've learned to do that when I give talks, when I do programs with Cindy Miller and Alan Jones. I've learned to talk to the audience, even if I can only see one person. And I don't just stare at that one person, but that's my guidepost. And so I never have to worry about feeling stilted when I'm saying something. And that's when I think whatever else was going on, and maybe the voice too, clicked in. And that took a couple of months.
Well, let's get a little bit more music before we're done here. Irving Berlin, Michael says, is the greatest songwriter. Songs were so simple that they lulled you into thinking he just cranked them out. This is Always. You have Always?
We have Always, and it's a deceptive song. Everybody thinks, oh, it's so nice. I love you'll love me always and forever. Listen to the verse. The relationship between the verse and the refrain is always interesting.
Let's listen.
Everything went wrong, and the whole day long, I'd feel so to smile, then I met you. Now that my blue days have passed, now that I found you at last, I'll be loving you.
Michael Lasser. Okay. Continue the education here.
That song, could it be simpler? This is not a somebody who simply found perfect love. Whoever it is, the narrator in the song, let's make it a he because most of the songwriters were men and so they would probably see the world then from a male perspective. He's been through something. He's lost a love. He's been through the pain and the confusion and the despair, perhaps. Everything felt blue. But now he's met someone, and so there is this present moment that is the refrain, I'll be loving you. But notice, it's not about now. It's now about tomorrow. It's now about the future. And so he goes very deftly from past to present at the end, now I've met you, at the end of the verse, and then the future, the refrain, is really about the future. And it won't be perfect. I can't think of the line off the top of my head, but when there are problems, I'll understand. Mm-hmm. And so it's a kind of an honest reflection, a real reflection in very romantic terms of what a love affair, what a marriage is like.
Wise, a very wise song.
And people think, oh, Always, it's so nice. Well, it
light
is.
Light and airy, but no, it's
it
very
is,
wise.
But there's some, those popular songs with their simplicity and their sentimentality tell truths. If you're listening. If you're not listening, take a bath.
I'm going to be sadly out of time in a moment. We're going to kick with Our Love Is Here to Stay. Is that okay, Rob?
Yeah.
So in 30 seconds, can you set this up?
Their last song together, George died while they were still writing it.
George and Ira Gershwin.
Yes, it's come to be seen, and rightly so, I think, as Ira's love song to his brother.
20 seconds. What will it mean to you thinking about your career with this man?
Just some wonderful memories, and thanks for the memories, is the thing.
Shut up and kiss
so
me.
It's so, but I also want to say thank you to WXXI, because when we started the show, We were flying blind. You know, I had never been in that studio when I walked in there. So XXI gave us the opportunity to fail, to learn, and that was what's so fantastic about working here.
Those are the days of splicing tape, when you did it in real time.
I know we're going to see more of you.
When?
Come on. All right. You've got more books you're working on.
Yeah, I've got books I'm working on.
And I am thrilled that you're still doing that. Here is to the greatest congratulations that
thank you, Evan.
From everybody.
The interviews that you've done with me have been enormously satisfying, and I thank you for them. You're good at what you do.
Well, you are a gift to this community. That's Michael Lasser, celebrating four decades of fascinating rhythm. Tune in with him for the last time on These Airwaves on June 26th. But as he said, YouTube, books. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you.
Thanks to Rob, Emma Ray, Megan Mack, Evan Dawson. Let's listen to this and take us home here, George and
Emma. But oh my dear, our love is here to stay.